My guest is neurologist Dr. Oliver Sacks. His book of case studies, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, was a bestseller. Dr. Sacks has described himself as a reporter of the human condition in extremis. His patients have severe neurological disorders, such as aphasia, Parkinson's disease, and Tourette's syndrome, disorders which have deprived them of memory, movement, cognition, or sensation. Dr. Sacks' diagnoses penetrate to the moral, spiritual, and psychological dilemmas these disorders cause. Much of his work has been done with patients who live in the back wards of charity hospitals and asylums, people who the medical profession has given up on. In the late 60s, he began his work with victims of sleeping sickness, whom he described as living statues. He awakened them from that state by administering the then-new drug L-DOPA. His 1973 book about this work, Awakenings, was published in a new edition this year. Awakenings inspired the Harold Pinter play, A Kind of Alaska. And Sacks' latest book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, was turned into an opera of the same name by British composer Michael Nyman. It received its American premiere this week at the American Music Theater Festival in Philadelphia. Dr. Oliver Sacks, welcome to Fresh Air.
Nice to be here.
Before we talk about the medical and spiritual implications of the work that you do, I'm going to ask you to tell the story of the man who mistook his wife for a hat, one of the case studies that you've written about. This was a music teacher and singer who didn't recognize that he had a disorder. What were the symptoms that he was showing?
Well, the first problem was that he had difficulty recognizing his students at the music academy. As soon as they spoke, he recognized them at once, but he couldn't recognize them visually. And soon he couldn't recognize anyone or anything visually. He couldn't recognize his wife. He couldn't recognize himself. He couldn't recognize common objects. He saw them perfectly clearly, but what he saw carried no meaning for him and no sense. And this prompted him to sort of ingenious, but sometimes wild, and sometimes absurd guesses as to what he might be seeing.
And you titled the case study, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, because in reaching for his hat, he reached for his wife's head by mistake.
When I saw him in a first interview, he was obviously not demented, but a delightful, intelligent, civilized man with a sense of humor. He kept encountering the fact that he made mistakes, but he didn't recognize what the problem was. And it mixed with all his intactness. There was a succession of absurd mistakes. At one point, he confused his left foot with his shoe, and he didn't seem to know which was which. And then right at the end, when he went to reach for his hat, he got his wife's head instead.
What is the condition that he had?
Well, this is called a visual agnosia. And what happens is that the normal meeting between visual input, between images and a person's memories and ideas and feelings and expectations, doesn't occur. And so, this goes with a problem in the visual association areas at the back of the brain. And so he sort of had raw vision, a sort of raw seeing, which didn't ascend into the realm of meaning.
Although he couldn't make sense of what he saw, he was a musician and singer, and he still had perfect musical sense. And your prescription to him was music. Why?
He was really absolutely lost in this meaningless, shattered visual world. And he desperately needed some way of organizing himself. Now, I think all of us tend to either use internal speech or internal music to organize ourselves to some extent. I mean, one has things like nursery rhymes, One, Two, Buckle My Shoe, or marching songs or work songs, but the song as a unit of organization became tremendously important and crucial for this man, who was so totally lost visually, couldn't use any visual organization, but in fact was a marvelous musician and singer, and a man who sort of generated songs all the while. And one saw again and again that he couldn't dress, he couldn't shave, he couldn't eat, unless he really set the activity to music internally. On one occasion when he was eating, there was an interruption, there was a sudden, the postman suddenly knocked at the door, and this This completely shattered the activity, and he looked quite bewildered for a few seconds until he was able to recapture the melody of eating.
You know, your prescription of music reminds me of something that your friend, the poet W.H. Auden, had said to you, which is that, he spoke of the poetic and religious states of affliction. And I wonder what you think, how that applies to your work, the poetic and religious states of affliction.
I thought you were going to actually quote one of Auden's favourite quotations from Novalis, where Novalis says, every disease is a musical problem and every cure is a musical solution. And certainly with Dr. P, as with many of my Parkinsonian patients, who are people sometimes who can't move unless they sing or dance. You know, one sees absolutely they've been unmusicked by disease and can be remusicked back into health. I think that the poetic and the religious are almost sometimes an integral part of patients' perceptions as to what may be happening with them. Something I describe in the Hat book and also at more length in an earlier book, A Leg to Stand On, as a patient whom I saw as a student who had apparently lost his left leg. He was found on the floor, very bewildered. He'd apparently thrown himself out of bed in a peculiar way. And the story he gave was that he had woken up from sleep. He had found that there was a foreign leg in the bed with him. Disgusting object. He threw it out. And then, and now horribly, he had come out with it, and now it was attached to him. And I said, but it's your leg? And he said, you know, shouldn't I know my own leg? And I said, yes, you should. And he said, well, I know it's not my leg. Now, this thing for him was not only was terribly wrong. It felt ugly. It felt hateful. It felt obscene. It felt unholy. It felt an offence against nature. The particular physiology in his case was that he had a tumour in the opposite side of the brain, which had expanded while he slept, and had blotted out the part of the brain which represents the leg. So the leg image had been obliterated. Therefore, he could not recognize his leg as his own. Therefore, it seemed absolutely other. But the absolutely other always seems uncanny and horrible and obscene and unholy. And God forsaken, and words like this, or concepts like this, will be used by every patient, irrespective of background, of intelligence, of education. The alienation is almost intrinsically in the area of subjectivity, is sort of felt as anti-poetic, anti-religious. And by the same token, when it comes back, there's the feeling, to quote Dante, of the holy and glorious flesh restored. And so I think even at this level, sort of the body in health is always felt as sort of as beautiful and holy, although one may not appreciate this unless it's taken away and one suddenly deals with a radically depreciated world.
Your way of writing case studies is really very literary. It's not empirical. It's not cut and dry. You're really describing states of mind as well as neurological conditions, and I've wondered if patients talk to you that way, if they are as descriptive as you are in telling their stories.
I think obviously this will depend on the condition and the patients, but above all, I think on the situation, in that if a patient is not permitted, implicitly or explicitly, to talk about himself, if he's reduced, if he's given a sort of catechism, do you have this, do you have that, then he will reduce himself to a list of symptoms. He won't say what it's actually like. He won't depict the world he is in, which he's been thrust into. But I think that if patients have a complaint, sometimes more serious or as serious as their primary complaint is that they can't communicate what it's like. And I think that a major act of the Doctor is somehow to, De Quincey once talked about the pressure of the incommunicable upon the heart, is to let the patient try and communicate, and the Doctor must sort of help him, must reach out to delicately to assist this trembling communication, and so that between them, the way it is, the world of illness is can come into being.
You've done a lot of your work on backwards of hospitals, charity hospitals, asylums. Why have you gone there looking for the kinds of cases you are interested in studying?
Well, it was really not quite in that order. I was there in places which most of my colleagues wouldn't be seen dead in, and which no ambitious young doctor would go to, and which are felt to be the sticks. But in fact, here there is the, you know, there's the priceless gift of leisure. There's no pressure to diagnose. There's no pressure to do anything. Also, you can encounter a complete world. I mean, these places are really little worlds. And I think that an unpressed exploration of getting deeper and deeper is possible in such places. It's hardly possible in any other places.
There's no pressure because they're considered hopeless anyways?
Partly. This was, incidentally, was well realized by the founders of neurology, by Hewlings, Jackson, and Charcot in the last century. They spent much of their lives in chronic hospitals, institutions, asylums. But now now doctors don't. But certainly with the patients I describe in Awakenings, these people who had been in hospital for 40 years or more since the great sleeping sickness epidemic, I had no idea that such patients existed, that such lives existed, until I went into a chronic hospital.
Has that happened other times, too, that you found disorders that have not really been described before?
Well, certainly they haven't been described with the richness and the fullness which they should have. In general, I think description has become sort of obsolete.
You've described it as almost a 19th century
yes.
art in medicine.
Yeah. I love 19th century medicine and science. It may have been so short in a way on certain empirical remedies and even relatively short on physiological concepts, and of course very short on technology. But the respect for the patient and for the detail of what was happening to them, I think, you know, could often generate almost novelistically rich and at the same time sort of medically and scientifically accurate descriptions. So much so now that there's major discoveries have been made by going back over 19th century descriptions. Now we can see what went on. I think most of the descriptions now are so meagre, so threadbare, you know, and also so they're too quick to diagnose, to pin labels on.
When you're working with patients who have been almost abandoned by the medical profession, it's just a kind of caretaking type of thing, are you able to do anything to really change their condition, or are you more interested in observing them? And let's leave out the sleeping sickness patients, because
yeah,
sure, you were able to administer
yes.
a new drug there that totally changed their condition. But in other cases where there isn't a drug that's going to change their state, what can you do?
There's a sort of doubleness between, the investigator and the physician, and sometimes they can go beautifully together. Sometimes they can sort of interfere with each other. But my first notion is to try and understand, with the patient what's going on. I recently retitled my first book, Understanding Migraine. It's not treating migraine, it's understanding it. Now, from the understanding, treatment may come. So that, for example, with one case I describe in the Hat Book, as I call it for short, as a Parkinsonian man who leant grossly to one side, although he wasn't aware of this. He was surprised that people commented. I took a videotape of this, I played it back to him. And it was only when he saw this that he realized what was happening. And he then asked a very acute question. He said he wondered whether there were balancing mechanisms. He used to be a carpenter, like spirit levels, like bubble levels, in the head, which had been impaired by his disease. And I said, yeah, exactly. And he then thought again, and he wondered if one couldn't make such little levels outside the head, for example, attached to by a nose clip to the glasses, and whether this would serve to balance him. And I said, oh, it's a wonderful idea, let's try it. And in fact, it worked beautifully. Now, here is a man who, all I did, in a sense, was to...
Give him a metaphor.
Yes, I, did, right? or he gave himself a metaphor. No, I assisted his understanding and indeed his movement to a cure. I mean, I love this sort of collaboration. When it's possible.
I want to talk with you about some of the current work that you're doing. But first we're going to take a short break. My guest is neurologist Dr. Oliver Sacks, whose books of case studies include Awakenings and The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Neurologist Dr. Oliver Sacks is my guest. Now, lately, some of the work you've been doing is in communities. Instead of looking at individuals with disorders, you're looking at communities that have a high level of disorders within them.
I've just actually come back from Canada where I saw, I was in a village, a Mennonite community in northern Alberta, where a third of the people have a thing called Tourette's syndrome, with sudden convulsive movements and exclamations. I've seen individuals with Tourette's, and I've written about them, but I've never sort of seen a community which had to grapple with this.
It seems very inexplicable to me that there'd be a community
Well, here there's in this community, there's a genetic basis, and with intermarriage, it's become commoner. I'm reminded somewhat of a, there was a, on Martha's Vineyard, there was a hereditary deafness for more than two centuries, and the rest of the community responded by learning sign. And in fact, sign became native to everyone, and it became oddly difficult sometimes to find out about the deafness. A woman called Nora Ellen Gross wrote a very beautiful book about this and described how in interviews she would say, was so-and-so deaf? And so-and-so might be remembered as a good friend and a fisherman, and a joker, a prankster, a scholar. But was he deaf? Come to think of it, people would say, come to think of it, he was deaf, except one never thought of it. You know, he was just the same as everybody else. Up in this place in Canada, partly people are not seen as having Tourette's. They say, sure, you know, grandmother twitched a bit and made faces and noises, but that's only natural. But in here, one moves into a sort of clinical anthropology as to what the whole community is like, what it is like to have Tourette's in Le Crete, what it is like to be deaf in Martha's Vineyard or some of the other places in the world where there are many deaf people, and how disease is conditioned by culture and community and vice versa.
Do people see their diseases differently when there's people around them who share it?
Oh, very much so. I mean, one is not singled out and one is not set apart in the same way. And it, to some extent, it almost becomes, as it were, our, you know, the way we are. Or else it ceases to be seen as a disease. And which was very clearly the case in Martha's Vineyard, where, you know, where in fact the deaf were as able as everyone else, and on the whole better educated than anyone else. They all went to the American asylum, and the lawyers and others on the, you know, were all deaf.
I'm interested in how you developed the sense of empathy that I think it's clear you feel with the patients who you work with.
I think I was very slow to do it. My own approach was was through the natural sciences. I was first had a passion for physics and later biology and later physiology. I only sort of got to individuals relatively late, you know. I don't really, but I think that if one listens, I think one has to restrict the urge to do something straight away. You may indeed need to do something, but you've somehow got to listen first, and then you will be given predicaments. You're presented with human predicaments and stories of how it is. And I don't know, these are heartbreaking, these are funny, they're absurd, they're tragic. They're often all of these at once. I think some neurological predicaments are both dreadful and funny. And again, patients may often have an extraordinary sense of humorous detachment. Some of this comes in with Dr. P and the man who mistook his wife for a hat. Something really awful is being described, but it's also funny in a way.
Sure, it has elements of slapstick in
Yes,
it, really.
Oh, sure, and Dr. P knew this. I mean, one talks about spoonerisms, you know. Now, spoonerisms were invented, if you want, by an elderly academic at Oxford, Dr. Spooner, who had a stroke, became aphasic, and tended to confuse words and say thud and blunder instead of blood and thunder. But he then, in a sense, exploited his own condition humorously and made an art of his disability.
You know, some people wouldn't allow themselves to admit to the humor in a situation like that because it would be perceived as laughing at someone who had a problem.
Well, here, of course, it's not laughing at them. It is bringing humor as one can bring poetry to the way one is.
You, the way I understand it, had a migraine problem when you were younger.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering if that helped you be sensitive to the kinds of problems you've encountered as a doctor.
I think among my earliest, some of my earliest experiences, there was a family thing, was when I was about three or so, there would be visual migraines in which the appearances of objects would change and perhaps half of them would disappear, or sometimes they would appear unrecognizable. And when I came later to write my migraine book, perhaps a rather larger portion than one might expect deals with visual disturbances. And I think this again leads right on to the story of Dr. P's agnosia and, say, a patient I'm seeing at the moment, a gifted painter who suddenly lost all colour vision and sees in black and white. But I'm very, very fascinated by perceptual change. And I think I, as you suggest, I was probably sort of sensitized to this. When I was very young, I was forced to realize that vision, the world isn't just given to one in its form and color and movement and meaning, but in some sense it has to be constructed, and the eyes and the brain have to work right, otherwise one is in trouble. And another thing which struck me very much as a child was how if one closes one eye, the world immediately becomes flat.
Yes, yes.
Flat as a pancake. For some reason, I have very sharp stereoscopic vision and feel slightly disabled if I close one eye. But although I'm sort of... So I could never ignore the effects of the nervous system and of one's physical being. And at the same time, I always want to know the resonance as a physical being in being a person and perceiving and thinking and feeling and acting the way one does.
Well, I've always found that it's easier to see the larger things about the human condition in someone else's illness than it is about your own.
Yeah.
And when I'm in pain, I'm just thinking about the pain and not about the larger implications of it. I wonder if you're able to see the larger meaning when you have a problem, as you can see it when you're studying a patient who has a problem.
I don't know. The somewhat confessional book I wrote, A Leg to Stand On, is about being a patient with an alienated leg and trying to communicate this and failing and feeling sort of rather hopeless, and then a sort of horror about this, which I couldn't communicate, and then the the magic, the absolute wonder when it came back, and the way in which the gratitude and the delight, the incredulity of the convalescent. And I'm both sorry and glad that I had that experience, but I sort of try to explore it. But it was difficult, and that book obsessed and obstructed me for 10 years. I found it infinitely easier to write about other people.
You find all these implications about the arts in the work that you do, and several artists have been inspired by your work to do plays or operas based on it. There's an opera based on The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. There's a Harold Pinter play inspired by Awakenings. What has it been like for you to see your case studies transformed into art?
It's first and last. It's very strange. It's rather startling and in a way wonderful to have one's own experiences and one's former patients brought to life again, so that I will suddenly see Dr. P again in the Hat opera, and or seeing my patients come alive in the play of Awakenings. In writing, it seems to me that in a sense I convert patients, people, and events into words, and now they're being converted back.
Oh, back into people.
back into people. Back into events, and one can, as a writer, you can only say things on stage. You can show it specifically with Dr. P. One can show him being organized by music. You could only show this, in a sense, on stage and with music.
We only have just literally a couple of seconds left, but one of the people who's meant a lot to you in your life, A.R. Luria, who was a neuropsychologist, talked about combining the empirical and the romantic, or the classical and romantic, mm-hmm. in his work. Do you feel that's what you've been striving to do also? I haven't left you any time to answer this.
absolutely. When I once asked Luria what he saw as his central enterprise, he said he couldn't say it in one word, but he had to use two, and he said romantic science. And I would say, hopefully, exactly the same of myself.
I thank you very much for talking with us about your work. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
My guest has been neurologist Dr. Oliver Sacks. His book of case studies, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, has been turned into an opera, which had its U.S. premiere this week at the American Music Theater Festival in Philadelphia. One of his earlier books, Awakenings, has just been republished in paperback by Summit Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with operatic baritone Cheryl Milnes, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, actress Mamie Van Doren talks about her years as a blonde bombshell. Van Doren starred in movies like High School Confidential and Guns, Girls, and Gangsters. She's written a memoir titled Playing the Field. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from the British group Squeeze. It's called Babylon and On. And guest film critic Michael Schrago reviews The Pickup Artist, the new film starring Molly Ringwald and Robert Downey, directed by James Toback. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. In California, Los Angeles area residents are soothing their shattered nerves after this morning's harrowing earthquake. The quake struck at 7:42 a.m. and it measured 6.0 on the Richter scale. 3 people have been killed and at least 24 injured. There's been extensive minor damage within a 20-mile radius of the epicenter in Pasadena. Cracked buildings, shattered windows, ruptured gas lines, and several small fires. There have been at least 12 aftershocks since the first tremor. As NPR's Lori Garrett reports, this earthquake took scientists by surprise.
Scientists say this earthquake struck along the Elsinore-Whittier fault line, which runs in a north-south direction along eastern Los Angeles. Geologists and seismologists at the California Institute of Technology say they're a bit surprised by this earthquake. The Elsinore fault has been very quiet for over a century, and only small earthquakes have struck the fault line in the last 50 years. The largest earthquake on the fault hit in 1929. It was at least 100 times weaker than today's Los Angeles earthquake. Since the initial earthquake at 7:42 this morning, several aftershocks have rocked the Los Angeles area. Lucy Jones of the U.S. Geological Survey says the worst is probably over for Los Angeles now.
3% of earthquakes of this type have had larger earthquakes, larger or comparable earthquakes occurring 3 hours to 3 days after the event. If we reach tomorrow morning without a larger earthquake, we're down to about a 1% chance.
The earthquake was odd in that its effects varied greatly from place to place, but it was felt over a massive area extending from Las Vegas to the Mexican border. In Washington, I'm Lori Garrett.
Today, the opposition to Robert Bork's nomination to the Supreme Court picked up a previously uncommitted vote. A key Republican senator, Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, broke with his party and announced he will vote against Bork. Specter is a very important vote. He sits on the Judiciary Committee, and he is considered to have been the most astute questioner of Bork when the judge testified before the committee. Specter is only the second Republican to announce his opposition. The first was Bob Packwood of Oregon. U.S. government officials say they are taking a close look at a proposal today by Soviet General Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev for East-West talks on limiting military activity in the waters of northern Europe. Gorbachev made the proposal in an address to a public rally in the Arctic port of Murmansk. More on the speech from Jeremy Harris in Moscow.
Mr. Gorbachev said the militarization of the region was reaching disturbing levels. He claimed NATO and the United States were building up their forces in areas close to the Soviet Arctic territories. The Soviet leader called on NATO and the Warsaw Pact to start discussions on reducing naval and air force activity in the North Sea, as well as in the Baltic and the Greenland and Norwegian seas. He also suggested an international conference to consider a total ban on naval activity in selected areas of shipping lanes and international waters. If the international climate permitted, Moscow could allow Soviet shipping lanes in the far north to be navigated by foreign vessels with the assistance of Soviet icebreakers. Mr. Gorbachev's remarks represent a new focusing by the Soviet leader on an area of strategic importance to which he's previously paid relatively little public attention.
The BBC's Jeremy Harris. TV evangelist Pat Robertson said today he's a candidate for the 1988 Republican presidential nomination. Robertson made the announcement in the predominantly black Bedford-Stuyvesant neighborhood in New York.
On this day, October the 1st, I am declaring that I am an official candidate for the Republican nomination for the presidency of the United States.
Robertson said the decline of the family unit is the greatest crisis facing the United States today. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson for National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of the new album from the British band Squeeze. Ken says their music makes you want to dance, but still lets you think.
Please prepare for some shameless gush. The new album by the British rock band Squeeze, entitled Babylon and On, is one of the most purely enjoyable rock records I've heard all year. Its combination of catchy melodies, clever wordplay, and soulful singing has yielded one of those albums that becomes, for a space of time, the soundtrack of your life. You can't get the music out of your head. Now I'll calm down and get specific. Squeeze has been an on-again, off-again proposition for the past 10 years.
Through shifting commercial fortunes and changes in personnel, the one constant in the group has been the songwriting team of Chris Difford and Glenn Tilbrook. Their intricate, often melancholy compositions earn them many misguided comparisons to Lennon and McCartney when Squeeze first emerged at the tail end of English punk rock. While Difford and Tilbrook inherited the Beatles' respect for a well-crafted pop song, they also understood punk's yearning for simplicity and unpretentiousness. Squeeze shared with both the Beatles and British punk an edgy ambivalence toward American rock and its creators. This is the central idea behind a song called Some Americans. Squeeze from its new album Babylon and On. Over the course of the late 70s and early 80s, Squeeze was a success in England and a cult favorite in America. Over here, radio programmers were presumably intimidated by any rock band that had the wit to title one of its albums Cozy Fan Tutti Frutti. There's a sense in which Squeeze has always been too clever for its own good. Even when Difford and Tilbrook intend to be romantic and straightforward, they can often sound merely arch and ironic. But this new album showcases the strongest songwriting Squeeze has done in this decade. All the smart little puns and metaphors have a purpose other than to demonstrate the advantages of the British educational system. This is especially apparent on this soulful ballad, The Waiting Game.
You trust someone, you know the time it takes.
Whether Babylon and On is the album that makes Squeeze a hot rock act in America remains to be seen, but the album has already proven that brainy pop music can also go straight to your heart.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. You're listening to Fresh Air. She was born Jane Olander in a small South Dakota town. When she was 15, she was discovered by Howard Hughes and was on her way to becoming a Hollywood starlet. When she landed a movie contract at Universal in 1953, the studio changed her name to Mamie Van Doren. They were hoping that she would be the next Marilyn Monroe. But unlike Marilyn, she became best known for movies about rock and roll and teen rebellion. By the mid-60s, roles for blonde bombshells like Mamie Van Doren had dried up, and she left Hollywood. She played dinner theaters and summer stock and put together a nightclub act. Now Mamie Van Doren has written a memoir about her wild Hollywood adventures on and off screen and in and out of bed. She told me about one of the props that enhanced her sexpot image, the pointed padded bra.
The wardrobe department at the studio had made them, and they had made them for women there that didn't have as large as breasts as mine, but they said that I was to wear one even though my breasts were large, and I followed the orders, and lo and behold, my God, dangerous weapons.
Did you have to be careful that you didn't walk into objects?
Well, especially two-legged men when men with pants on.
What were they made of, those bras, so that they'd keep their shape?
Well, the one that I had was it was lined with satin. It was very smooth, so it almost looked like skin. And what they did is they took a bridle button, and then they would sew it to make it look like a nipple. Like you walked around with hard nipples all the time.
Did the studio expect you to wear those padded bras in your off hours so that you could maintain the image?
One I had at the studio, and then they had another one for me to take home, if you know, to wear. So I guess they did. They expected me to keep that image.
But did you?
No, I didn't like wearing bras. I always just sort of, you know, I wore them when I went to the studio, but sometimes I didn't, and then the head office would call me in and tell me that I had to put my bra back on. I mean, the 60s was a feminist movement, and they burned their bras, and it was really the end of the platinum blonde era, but I welcomed it because I was really for that scene. I mean, I just didn't like what I had to do.
You were introduced to rock and roll by starring in rock and roll movies. Which are some of the rock and roll movies you were in?
I did Running Wild, and then I did Untamed Youth at Warner Brothers, which didn't get a seal of approval because it was too risque. I did High School Confidential, College Confidential, Girls Town. Well, I've done quite a few. Sex Kittens Go to College.
You even sang The Girl Who Invented Rock and Roll. Do you remember the lyrics? Could you do a chorus of it?
Now you've heard of instant coffee. You've heard of instant tea. See here, you guys, just feast your eyes on little old instant me, 'cause I'm the girl. Oh, I'm the girl. I'm the girl who invented rock and roll.
That's great. It's just great. Well, High School Confidential is about
marijuana and all that.
Yeah, it's a young hipster who's asked to infiltrate a high school and find out who's dealing dope.
And it's very moralistic at the end about how this could happen in your school.
Oh, I think it's hilarious. I watch that occasionally and see myself falling drunk on the floor. Charlie, one thing I can't stand is a man who can't hold his liquor. You know, and then I collapse over this guy.
Well, I was thinking that probably while you were making this movie that was supposed to have this anti-drug moral at the end, that probably half the actors...
were stoned.
Exactly.
Oh, I'm sure. In fact, I know one of them was. You know how he got us through his lines. Oh, yeah, it was going on then. I mean, marijuana didn't just happen. That thing has been going around since God knows.
Now, it's interesting. Your husband, Ray Anthony, was a big band leader. And in the 50s, when you were making these rock and roll movies, this was a time when there was this big split between big band dance music and rock and rollers. And you started hanging out with the rock and rollers. So that must have caused a lot of friction at home with your big band leader husband.
Well, I just think that it was very difficult for him to accept the fact that his wife was doing all the rock and the very thing that was supporting us was taking away his jobs, you know, because the big band was just disappearing. It was very sad, and I think that's one of the reasons why our marriage did not last.
You became a mother at the age of 23, and the year that you became a mother was the same year that Universal dropped you. Did it have to do with your becoming a mother?
I believe so. I mean, my image had been billed as a so-called sex symbol, and they told me in the hospital as they gave me the walking papers. That was really a nice present. But it's just as well. I mean, I was glad to get out of there if that's the way they felt.
What were the first signs that your kind of glamour was on the way out?
Well, when the phone doesn't ring anymore and you don't get, you know, the roles that you would like to get, you know. Hollywood has a way of letting you know with silence. And some of those things in Hollywood are very sad. And I had to leave because I didn't hang around to be abused by the system.
One of your projects now is raising money for AIDS.
Yes.
Huh? Why is that an important cause for you?
Well, I did it like back in when it wasn't the in thing to do. You know, when you lent your name to a name like AIDS in 1983, you know, it was a no-no. Celebrities wouldn't even think of it. They didn't want to be associated with the word AIDS. And I'm blowing my own horn, but you asked me, so I did. I managed to raise $30,000 on my own by appearing at some little places and doing some appearances and things like that. I did it because I knew at the time I was doing it that this was going to be a real bad scene, and nobody could foresee it. It wasn't going to just strike gays. It was going to strike... it'll strike the world, humanity.
So much of your book is about your sexual adventures, including how you once tried to buy a gross of condoms because a lot of the men were really irresponsible about birth control, so you figured you'd better carry it yourself. And I couldn't help but think how different your life would have been had you been coming of age now.
We still had a couple of bad venereal diseases, and also we did not have legal abortions. And if you got pregnant, you know, you lent yourself to a butcher, and you know, and that was quite common in those days. So it was, you know, you had problems then too. It wasn't all that easy. But I would not want it to be out in the jungle today. I mean, I really feel for the people that are promiscuous, and they have to really be careful.
You know, you mentioned the risks that women have always taken when they engage in sex. You know, if they don't want to get pregnant, there's always that risk of pregnancy. And when you were younger, abortion was illegal. Was that on your mind a lot? Did you always have this sense of risk during your period when you were having a lot of relationships?
Very much so. That was the first thing you thought of. Well, what time of the month is it? You know, you're very scared because when you sign a contract at a studio, there's a clause in any act of God that any kind of scandal, I mean, you're automatically dropped. And I always remember when I was very young, I was growing up, and I watched and looked at the newspapers when poor Ingrid Bergman was just absolutely, she was deported from this country just because she was pregnant by another man. I mean, it was just, I mean, that scared me. I mean, I really got scared. And you grow up with these fears, and the only thing I could think of was just go out and buy my own condoms. And if they didn't have them, I had one for them. Well, I just happen to have one. If you want, you know, I mean, a lot of men were really taken aback to think that I was thinking like that. I mean, they got mad sometimes, you know. I'd say, well, it's your problem, you know.
Did you end up having to give sexual responsibility and birth control lectures to a lot of the men who you slept with?
No, if they were that dumb, I just didn't like them. I mean, I don't like dumb men. If they aren't aware of taking care of me as a woman at that time, as young as I was, I just didn't go to bed with them. Now, I think men are the opposite. Men will marry dumb women, but I don't think smart women will marry dumb men.
Mamie Van Doren, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
Mamie Van Doren's memoir, Playing the Field, is published by Putnam. Here's Jerry Lee Lewis with the theme from High School Confidential.
Open up, honey, it's a lover boy, me, that's knocking. Well, listen to my baby, all the cats are at the high school rocking. Honey, get your bopping shoes before the jukebox blows a fuse.
This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you following?
We're following the earthquake in Los Angeles this morning, and we'll also have a little bit of a geology lesson from Laurie Garrett explaining to us how these things happen.
What about Pat Robertson's announcement that he's going to run for president?
Yes, Mike Schuster reports from Brooklyn, New York, on that. Also, we'll hear from Linda Wertheimer about just who is Pat Robertson. And we'll have a couple of reports about the situation in Ethiopia. I've seen a devastating drought and famine just a few years ago. There are now fears that a coming famine could be just as bad, and there are urgent pleas to Western relief agencies for help.
Okay, thank you, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our guest film critic, Michael Schrago, has a review of the new James Toback movie, The Pickup Artist. It stars Molly Ringwald and Robert Downey, whose father is director Robert Downey. Schrago says The Pickup Artist isn't anything like the other Brat Pack films.
In The Pickup Artist, writer-director James Toback, the Norman Mailer disciple who won notoriety with weird and funny movies like Exposed, way outstrips his master, both in movie-making and in that rare ability to see himself as others see him. In this delightful and original romantic comedy, Toback creates an autobiographical Don Juan, as he did in Fingers, Love and Money, and his script for The Gambler. This time, Toback comes to us as a schoolteacher, Jack Jericho, who spends as much time cruising the sidewalks of New York as he does coaching his students in history or softball. But here, for a change, Toback also creates an immovable object to match his irresistible force. She's Randy Jensen, a solid 19-year-old Coney Island woman who works as a tour guide in the Museum of Natural History. And when Jack tries to pitch the woo to this girl, she tosses him a few curves of her own.
My name's Jack Jericho. I must say, that rose goes magnificently with your pale skin and dark eyes and white teeth and pink lips and red hair. Has anyone ever told you you have the face of a Botticelli and the body of a Degas?
I'm a 10th grade art teacher.
What do you think of a perfect stranger coming up to you on the street and giving you a rose?
I think with an opening like that, there's nowhere to go but down.
Randy is tougher than Jack is. She wants to love him and leave him. The Pickup Artist is a look at youthful Don Juanism from the inside out and the outside in. Because Robert Downey plays Jack and Molly Ringwald plays Randy, the male and female halves of Toback's comic equation are absolutely equal, whether in vividness or strength or humor. The result of this balance is a comic and dramatic tension that's unusually strong for a light comedy. What seems like harmless banter turns out to have bite.
You feel great?
Fine.
Not great?
Would it upset you terribly if I chose my own words?
Absolutely not. I love the way you talk.
Look, I gotta get to work, but let me get your phone number.
No, I can't.
Why? You married?
No.
Boyfriend?
Uh-uh.
Then what's your problem? Look, you fit it right here. See?
I don't give out my telephone number.
After what we've just been through?
That was in the past. Phone number's in the future.
The movie is filled with eccentric and funny performers like Dennis Hopper, Danny Aiello, writer-director Robert Towne, Christine Baranski, and the gifted comedian Victoria Jackson. But the movie belongs to Downey and Ringwald. Downey is a fluid comedian, as well as a startling, ardent leading man. He gives Jack a conviction that's downright disarming. And Toback prepares us from the start to catch the glinting mischief in his performance. Jack doesn't just rehearse his come-ons in the bathroom mirror. He even rehearses his reactions. Ringwald has a chance to display the growing strength and maturity that a succession of teen romances have kept under a snuggly blanket. She doesn't telegraph her emotions. Her elastic expressions show them coursing up through her and blooming. The movie has major plot problems, and it doesn't go as far with the characters as you hope. But it does succeed in depicting that moment when a Don Juan turns into a lyrical lover pursuing a feminine ideal. The pickup artist has wit, sweetness, and exuberance. Three qualities that have never been more rare or precious in American films.
Michael Schrago is movie critic for the San Francisco Examiner. Here's the Beastie Boys from the soundtrack of The Pickup Artist.
I spent the last dollar to buy some Sprite. When I seen this girl, I could never forget.
Now I like pretty girls.
And I haven't seen a smile that pretty in a while. The girl came up to me,
said she loved the show.
Her ass do come on.
And she couldn't say no.
We got to the crew.
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with horror writer Clive Barker. He's made his directorial debut with the film Hellraiser, a horror movie about sadomasochistic obsessions. Also, critic at large Laurie Stone will discuss the sexual messages implicit in two new TV series, Beauty and the Beast and Werewolf. And accordionist and composer Guy Klusevic will play Polkas from the Fringe. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.